Hello.
Good evening.
Oh, hello. How's the rain?
Say again.
How's the rain? Is it beginning to stop or?
Oh, it's been gone all day, but they finally got the electricity fixed, so we should get back to normal tonight or tomorrow.
Ruby.
Okay. Sounds good.
Good evening, Ruby. It's nice to hear you.
Good. Thank you. How are you? How's everybody?
Everything is normal. The electricity got turned back on. So we're all doing well.
Okay. Well, I'm going to mute my phone.
Okay. Sana, are you ready?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So we're in verse 71 in this section 10 of Parashat Noah from the Zohar Sulam. We'll start with the L'shem Yichud. L'shem Yichud kudcha b'richu ishkinte bitchilu urchimu udchilu urchimu. Le'afta l'shem yudhe b'vavhe. V'yichuda shalim b'shem kol Yisrael. Limud Torah mitzvah. La'asok Torah mitzvah. Vayhino amadunai Elohim elena masaya dena kunene elena masaya dena kunenehu. Tachatze noach zaka ahawa. Atre bivne direa vilahawo. Shama leya adikucha. Perichu ate. Alaihu dina, tegehinom mai dina, tegehinom esha, betol gamayayo, beshadat sanina, bedadet riticha, bekohod bedina, tegehinom itzdanu, Vitavidu me'alma. Come and see. Noah, the righteous, warned the people of his generation, but they did not heed him until the Holy One, blessed be He, brought the punishment of Gehinom upon them. What is the punishment of Gehinom? It is fire and snow, water and fire. The first is cold and the other boiling. And all of that generation were sentenced to punishment in Gehinnom and lost from the world. Questions, comments, thoughts?
Was fire and snow a little more merciful than water and fire?
Well, it depends. In one sense, cold is more merciful than fire, but cold burns just as well as fire does.
Well, I was thinking maybe the snow cooled the fire. That's why I thought a little bit more merciful. Mercy first and more judgment after. I mean, I know when you throw water on a fire, it just makes the fire bigger just about. At least you don't throw fire on a fire, you know. Anyway, that was my thoughts.
And it's a good valid thought. Welcome, Malka. We're talking about verse 71.
Okay.
Well, if you look at those four words and then you look at what comes after it, it kind of doesn't make sense. Because fire and snow, is that one thing or is it two things? water and fire. Is it one thing or is it two things? And then it says the first is cold. So it's saying that fire and snow together is one thing. And then water and fire is one thing. And that's really a very apt description of, in a very succinct way, of what is Gehinnom, what is hell, what is Abaddon. And it's basically saying what the whole generation, all of the 10 generations from Adam until Noah, none of those people reincarnated in ways. They were all sent to Abaddon and they never came up. Now their souls did, their souls were, you know, partitioned into other people, but those people by name as identity, they never resurrected. They're never there. They're all, you know, their bodies are gone. And that entity known as ABC, or, you know, living in those generations, never came together again.
Mm-hmm. So that can happen again for generations, then the generations that we're in as well.
No, because of generations that, an individual, it can happen to an individual in the generations that we're in, but it can't happen to the whole generation.
Because we are correcting the generations.
Because we are working towards improving, because we have the tool of the Torah, which they didn't have. Because we have the tool of the Zohar, which earlier generations didn't have.
But they were so much more spiritual minded. I mean, they knew of the hand of God, right? And because they could maneuver the letters, and they had more, they had prophets and, you know, more righteous people in their generation. They had, they had more light, you know, of the Creator than we do.
They didn't have more light. We have more light because we are dependent, or we're connected to the light from previous generations. Their world was one of darkness. There wasn't knowledge in their world.
Okay.
They were higher spiritually.
I guess that's what I was trying to get out there.
But they were following after the illusion of the pleasures of physicality. Remember, it says that the earth was corrupted by the human activity. One of the meanings of that is that people were following their own ideas of pleasure. They weren't caring about what would happen to the earth or to the animals. They just went ahead and did what felt good to them. So some entity inhabited, was given permission to inhabit a tree or a rock. And as they walked by, they got this shot of pleasure in their pleasure centers. And then they said to them in their mind, you know, this is how I want you to serve me. And they said, sure, no problem. Because they were after the physical sensation of pleasure. Uh, And there is a difference between the physical sensation of pleasure and the spiritual sensation of pleasure. And if you've never experienced the spiritual sensation of pleasure, it can't be described as what is the difference. But the difference is very... And because we have the tools before us, and because we have the deadline, we have the ability to get taste of that physical, of that spiritual sensation of pleasure. Should I go on, or do we need to talk more about this first? I'll take nobody's answer as we're moving on to verse 72.
Am I still connected? I'm not sure.
Yes, you are.
Okay.
Yes, you are. There's a lot static, though.
Yes, and you go in, you fade in and out, so I'm not too sure. But yes, go on.
Okay. Verse 72. Ubatar itkayam al makidka chazeleya vial noach batav seva vial ael bako zina vizina vial mazadai noach etzose perihawa. Venafku min teva kol ziyane alma kogavna dilela. After that punishment, the world was able to exist and function correctly. Noah entered the ark and brought into it all the Jesus creatures. So, of course, Noah was a priest. Yielding fruit, meaning that he was Yesod, who is called righteous. And then all the species of the world emerged from the ark, just as it happened above, meaning just as in Yesod and Malchut above. Question, comment, thought. I don't know. Hannah, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
I caught.
I think it's saying that. Go ahead, Malcolm.
I'm sorry. I caught half of it. I was driving.
You want me to read it again?
Oh, yeah, go ahead so she can hear it.
After that punishment, which is really not punishment, it was the effect of their actions, the world was able to exist and function correctly. Noah entered the ark and brought into it all the species of creatures. So, of course, Noah was a fruit tree yielding fruit, meaning that he was Yesod, who is called righteous. And then all the species of the world emerged from the ark, just as it happened above, meaning just as in Yesod and Malchut above.
Okay, so with that said, my thought is that the animals, they were of one kind. They weren't mixed. So they were pure when they came out of the ark. So it was a cleansing, because I believe that there was mixing of species.
it be from the animal life through the plant life. So that's kind of my thought. I'm not sure if that's the way to go.
Well, it's accurate. The Midrash says that because of human activity, the animal species were impregnating cross species lines, and so different animals were being created through that process, and that those mixed species would not have been allowed into the ark. So when Noah brought them into the ark, he was bringing in pure lines, pure species, but all of the different kinds of species.
I thought I remembered that the raven didn't obey the law, though, and did mate during that time. That was why he didn't come back. I said, I thought somewhere
up.
I remember reading that the raven did not obey the rule of no sexual activity or no mating during that time on the ark, and that's why the raven didn't come back. But I don't remember where I read it.
There is a midrash that says the raven was one of two species that didn't follow the law within the ark that there was to be no sexual activity. So the raven mated, and the other species was, I believe, who was it? Believe it was Ham. Or the result of the mating was Ham, who then was the father of Canaan. I forget the lineage. But one of Noah's sons did not maintain the sexual limitation. And the raven was the other one. And the explanation for why the raven didn't come back I hadn't heard that that's the explanation. I'd never really heard an explanation for why the raven didn't come back. That doesn't mean that you're incorrect on it, because there are many different midrashim.
Right. But it's basically telling us because of Noah, you know, building the ark, following Hashem's direction, entering the ark, and that here we are at Yesod and being able to reach Malkut when the flood is over.
Correct. But the important question to ask is, what does it mean that it happened above, meaning just as in Yesod and Malchut above? Was he talking about the world of Atzilut? Or was he talking about the Sephirot of Yesod and Malchut of Malchut, and indicating that the physical world is then below that level of consciousness? It's not really clear in the language, and at least in the English.
It's also in capital letters, which tells us it's Rabbi Ashlag's comments is helping us with that, too. With that phrase meaning, just as in Yesod and Malchut above, so.
Okay, but in my book, it isn't in capital letters, so.
Oh, well, okay. Also, Yesod, who is called righteous, is also in caps.
Yeah, that is true in mine as well. But as I'm looking at the Aramaic, I would agree with you that the Yesod and Malchut above is in capitals, meaning because it's not in the original Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
So do we know which Zephi wrote that is above? Does it say? Or is it just still not known?
No, the Aramaic is essentially ending at the statement, emerge from the ark just as it happened above. Then the meaning, just as in Yesod and Malchut above, is not in the language of the Aramaic. It's an addition by Rabbi Ashlag, which would imply, in my mind, it would imply that it's talking about Yesod and Malchut of Atzilut. But it's not clear.
So is it like as of when it was the creation up into that level as it was in the creation?
Well, the world of Atzilut is the creation.
Right.
The lower three worlds of Bria, creation, Yetzirah, formation, and Asiya, action, those lower three worlds are a process of bringing the energy down into physicality. But there's no continuity in those worlds. They will eventually be reabsorbed into Atzilut. We studied that in the sections of Bereshit when we were studying all those different stages of the earlier sections in Bereshit Bet.
Okay.
There's two more verses. We won't have enough time to finish the two verses tonight. So if you want to continue to talk about these verses or another subject, we can. We're still got about 7-8 minutes until our time is up. Otherwise, we'll just come back tomorrow and do it again for the last two verses of this section.
I have one question just pertaining to this. Who's the top authority in Kabbalah or Zohar in our generation? Is there one individual that is I won't say leader, but the authority figure?
The answer to that question is, my opinion is that there's no one leader. The person that was most instrumental in expanding the knowledge of the Zohar to others was Rabbi Berg of the Kabbalah Center before his death. And he left two children who are managing, along with his widow, the Kabbalah Center. And there are a number of people who have been taught by that organization. And so in that sense, the number of people would be the Kabbalah Center as the leader. But it's not. Then you have the Chabad organization, and you have other of the Hasidic groups where they study the Zohar, but they never promoted it to be studied by other people. if someone felt that they were ready to study Zohar, they were trained. They were sent to various teachers. But it was always done surreptitiously. It wasn't promoted. It wasn't made public. What the Kabbalah Center did was to say, anybody can study Zohar, whether you've been trained in Orthodox Judaism or not. The Zohar is there as a tool. The Hasidic groups say, well, I shouldn't say all of them. The Chabad organization says, you cannot study the Zohar directly unless you've studied the Tanya and you are well-versed in the Tanya, and you don't need to study the Zohar if you are well-versed in the Tanya. And they perceive that studying the Zohar itself directly is considered direct light, and you may not have the vessel for that. But if you study the Tanya, which is a commentary on the Zohar, that it's the equivalent of returning light, and then everybody can do that. So you have these competing concepts of who can study Zohar, people who are well-trained or anybody. And so there's no one idea, one person who is saying, merging these two concepts. And you always have to remember that the rabbis of our generation, most of them are, the root of their soul is Erev Rav. So they will have a tendency to create separation rather than unification. And we see that consistently in the Orthodox world and also in the conservative and the reform worlds as well. Once a student becomes a rabbi, they tend to exhibit choices that seem to create separation. So there is no one person that you can point to and say he is in charge. He's the authority on the Zohar. There is no authority on the Zohar, to my understanding, to my knowledge. Each individual who studies the Zohar has access to the wisdom of the Torah. And by having that access, depending on the purity of their vessel, they will receive the wisdom of the Torah, of Hashem. And if somebody is totally pure, then they receive all of the wisdom of the Torah. But of course, nobody in the physical world is totally pure.
Where is the Kabbalah Center?
Well, there's one in New York, there's one in Los Angeles, there's one in Chicago, there's one in Mexico City, there's one in two or three in various areas of Los Angeles. There's one in Tel Aviv, there's classes in Jerusalem, they're in London and Manchester. There's like 40 of them around the world. And if you go and visit a Kabbalah center in any city, their Shabbat services are all the same. And there's the sermon, the drash that is being given for that Shabbat is all the same. It's being given by teachers who have been trained by the Kabbalah center system. But in their communication, every Friday they get directions on what they should be talking about. And so when people go Friday night, if you ever experience a Kabbalat Shabbat in a Kabbalah center, it's an amazing amount of energy that is generated. tremendous amount of light. And, you know, the same thing Saturday morning. It's a different aspect. But their goal to spread the wisdom of the Zohar and the wisdom of the Kabbalah to as many people who will take it under and accept it and start to improve their own spiritual life. But they do not teach the deeper levels of the Kabbalah and of the Zohar. They don't go into the depth because there's no way to explain to their community, this person is able to learn these deeper levels and someone else is not. Because their approach is universal. Their approach is egalitarian. Here's the wisdom. Anybody can come and drink it. Anybody can come and learn it. And what you do with it is up to you. If you want to go deeper, you have to go find another teacher to teach you that. And just to give you some background, for me, that's what I did. I wanted more than what they were willing to teach, and so I found more than one teacher. I found a number of teachers, and I took wisdom from each of those teachers. But there's a danger in that, and the danger is when you mix teachers, you're mixing columns, you're mixing the sephirot, because each teacher represents a different sephirah. And so you need to have you need to be sure that you can discern the difference and how to integrate and manage when one teacher tells you that this is correct, XYZ is correct, and another teacher says, no, XYZ is wrong. How do you balance that? How do you integrate that? How do you understand that? You have to have that innate sense of right and wrong and what is correct. And I'm not saying that that's what I have, but that's what I struggled with all of my teachers that were not in the Kabbalah Center. But I found a way to do what I felt was right for me. And that's why when you ask questions, many, many times, I give you six answers. Maybe not six, maybe two, maybe four. But I give you as much information as I can in a way that makes sense so that you can start to make your own decisions about what is right for you. Because that is the difference between what the Kabbalah Center does in the sense of spoon-feeding you and what these other teachers that I found would never spoon-feed. And I think you know what I mean when I say spoon-feed.
Right.
So to answer your question, no. In my estimation and my understanding, there is no one rabbi, one teacher, who is speaking for all of the different ideas. They each have their own. They each have their own perception. And when you get into the depth of mind over matter, and you get into the deeper concepts of consciousness, you find that what a person sees or experiences or understands is really what they expected to understand. It's what's built into their agenda, their personal agenda, what they absorbed from their society. And until you break out of those limitations, that we all accepted as children growing up and going through education. We all were programmed in a certain way. Now, it's different if you're raised in England. It's different if you're raised in France. It's different if you're raised in the Middle East. But all of those different cultures impact people differently, and people see or experience or learn or understand what they expect to understand. And it's very few people who are truly searching for truth, whatever truth means to them. There are very few people who are saying, this person is right also. And so therefore what they're teaching me is correct also. But when this other person who is also correct is teaching me, I have to find a way to integrate those two diametrically opposed concepts. I have to find a way to balance them, to integrate them into my own world, in my own worldview, my own understanding. And that's not an easy process. So I hope I didn't toot my own horn too much in this last few minutes, because I don't really mean to do that.
See, what I found was the persons that I was studying with and getting their commentaries that you brought that into your teachings. So I was able to kind of let that go because it was too much you to handle as well as to support them, and so I felt like, well, the things that I should be getting from them, if I were getting anything, that you were bringing it into your own teachings. So that's how I handled the situation for myself.
What you're really saying is that you saw that I was bringing in all these different teachers that you were getting from different teachers, but I was integrating it for you or bringing it to you so that you could make your own decision. You didn't need to go to all the different ones. And that's literally what I strive to do.
You know, for a period of time, I subscribed to Rabbi Pincus Winston and supported his ministry. For a while, I did Rabbi Zadok, and, you know, on and on through the years, at least for the last 15, I guess I'd say. And gradually got to where I found you, so.
And you found that within what I taught was the teachings of Rabbi Winston, the teaching of Rabbi Bar Sadak, the teachings of Rabbi Abraham Sutton, the teachings of the B'nai Baruch group, the teachings of the Kabbalah Center. You know,
yeah,
those are the major Kabbalists that are still living. Because all of them came out of the Kabbalist schools in Jerusalem that Rabbi Kaduri was actually the head of for probably 50, 60 years. You know, he passed away and he was 108, some say 113, but he was at least 108 years old. And then afterwards, you had all this controversy about what he said and what he didn't say and so forth. But while he was alive, he had one student who he taught personally, and everyone else was taught in their lectures. And the way Rabbi Bar Sadak, who attended those lectures, the way he described it is you never... if you asked a question, Rabbi Kaduri didn't answer you. He quoted you a passage, page, and number in the Zohar. He directed you exactly where to get your answer. But he never gave you what that answer is. And if somebody said, well, that's not the way I want to learn, they asked him not to come back. Because they had an attitude that not everybody could learn the Zohar. And they weren't going to waste their time with somebody who wasn't willing to learn on his own. Whether that's right or wrong, that is the way the school works. Any other questions, or do we need to expand on anything I said, or are you just totally silent and stunned?
So the Zohar, there is a school in Jerusalem. Is that self? How do you? I forget where I read that. Possibly. Safed?
No, Safed is a city in the north of Israel. And there is an organization that publishes the website Kabbalah Online, but they're affiliated with the Chabad organization. So they publish, they fund the translation of many things into the English, but they're not really teaching Kabbalah per se. They're using it as a marketing tool, not as a set series of classes. And not as something that they're trying to teach people per se. They do run conventions, and they do run classes, and they do run seminars, and they're very good, because the teachers that they bring in are Rabbi Abraham Sutton and Rabbi Pinchas and Pinchas Winston and the more mainstream Orthodox Kabbalists. So that's who's doing the teaching in those seminars. But my sense of that organization is it's not truly developing a community. But in the city of Safed, Safed, you are getting a lot of people studying the Zohar in that community, in that city. But that's been true because that is the energy of the city of Safed. That's where the Ari lived and taught his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. And that's so for the last 500 years that community has been teaching Kabbalah. But it was always based on, were you Orthodox? Did you follow the Orthodox rules and tradition? And then a teacher, you would find a teacher, or the teacher would find you, and you would study, but you never promoted it. You never taught it to others. It was always kept very narrow in its distribution. And the people that changed that were the Kabbalah Center. In the early 90s, the late 80s, they started to expand the teachings of the Zohar to others. Didn't matter if you were your background wasn't Orthodox. It didn't matter, as long as you were willing to pay their fees, you could absorb whatever they were willing to give you. And whatever they were willing to give you is referred to as Ta'amei Torah, the taste of the Torah. It wasn't Sitre Torah. It wasn't the real secrets of the Torah. And that's why you will get, you know, some of the organizations became very jealous. I'm going to use the word jealous for lack of a better term. They became very jealous of the promotion of the Zohar, the attraction of the light of the Zohar that people found in the Kabbalah Center. And so they started to need to do something to maintain their communities, to maintain their students. So they started to teach. And now in the rabbinical schools, the Reform, the Conservative, all of them, there are classes in Kabbalah, but it's academic Kabbalah. They don't teach them to do the practices. They teach them the academics of it. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. It's a way of expanding the teachings of the Kabbalah. It's a way of getting more people to connect to that. But that approach did not satisfy me. And I kept searching for the deeper levels. And so I teach what I teach, and as long as somebody's willing to learn, I'll continue to teach it.
Well, may it be for a long time.
Amen. Are there any other questions or comments or thoughts? So tonight's class, hopefully we will do a letter of Teshuvah from the Tanya. And at 8:30, we will have a Tikkuni Zohar class, finally, after almost a week, Bezrat Hashem.
Okay.
Shalom to all.
Shalom. Thank you. Shalom, and thank you.
Shalom.
Shalom.